from decriminalization. On the immediate practical level, we would feel safer in our homes and on our streets and much less concerned about the danger of our cars being burgled. In cities like Vancouver, such crimes are often committed for the sake of obtaining drug money. More significantly, perhaps, by exorcising this menacing devil of our own creation, we would automatically give up a lot of unnecessary fear. We could all breathe more freely. Many addicts could work at productive jobs if the imperative of seeking illegal drugs did not keep them constantly on the street. It's interesting to learn that before the war on drugs mentality took hold in the early 20th century, a prominent individual such as Dr. William Stuart Halsted, a pioneer of modern surgical practice, was an opiate addict for over 40 years. During those decades, he did stellar and innovative work at Johns Hopkins University, where he was one of the four founding physicians. He was the first, for example, to insist that members of his surgical team wear rubber gloves, a major advance in eradicating post-operative infections. Throughout his career, however, he never got by with less than 180 milligrams of morphine a day. On this, said his colleague, the world-renowned Canadian physician Sir William Osler, he could do his work comfortably and maintain his excellent vigor. As noted at the Common Sense for Drug Policy website, Halsted's story is revealing not only because it shows that with a morphine addiction, the proper maintenance dose can be productive, it also illustrates the incredible power of the drug in question. Here was a man with almost unlimited resources, moral, physical, financial, medical, who tried everything he could think of, and he was hooked until the day he died. Today we would send a man like that to prison. Instead, he became the father of modern surgery. Most hardcore addicts could not function at such a high level, given the social and psychological adversity of their life histories. But surely, if their substance needs were met, they would have much greater opportunity to realize their potential to be creative and contributing members of society. At the very least, they would be a lesser burden. Decriminalization of drug use would establish the possibility of integrating addicts into the larger community, an essential step if they are to be rehabilitated in any large numbers. In Chapter 1, I introduced Stan, a native Canadian man, an addict and street dweller just out of jail. On chilly nights, Stan should not be sleeping on stone steps under an archway in the downtown East Side. Without having to steal to support his drug habit, he would not have lived in prison the past 18 months, but in a recovery home, or, if still needing to use, in a decent housing facility. He ought to be receiving remedial training for his learning disabilities and counseling to help him overcome the emotional defensiveness and impulse reactivity that has so often landed him in trouble. Such support would help prepare him to join normal society. Seeking insight into my First Nations patients, I spoke with psychiatrist Louis Mel Madrona, author of Coyote Medicine, Lessons from Native American Healing, and associate professor of family medicine and psychiatry at the University of Saskatchewan. People fall into these communities of substance centered around drugs, Dr. Mel Madrona pointed out. You can fall into communities around alcohol or cocaine and whatever. Everyone has a need to belong. Unless people have another community, an alternative community that provides them with more belonging, being wanted, and purpose, the so-called treatment always fails. What seems to work here for Aboriginal people is to switch their allegiance to an alternative community, modern but honoring traditional values. As long as they can maintain their position in that non-using community, they are not using substances. Louis Mel Madrona's insights apply not only to Native people, but to all the marginalized addicts who, like Stan, haunt the streets and alleys in the vicinity of the Portland Hotel. They need to be invited into communities that can offer them acceptance, belonging, and value. At least transitionally, such communities have to be founded and maintained with public support until, step by step, former users are fully able to join society at large. Those unable to give up their habits ought not to be ostracized, nor should their voices be excluded from social discourse. If we understood the sources of their dysfunction, we would want to reduce their suffering, whether or not they continue to use. Drug addiction has to be de-vilified, Bruce Perry said during our interview. If we create environments that are safe and predictable and relationally enriched, then all of the other factors involved in substance abuse and dependence will be so much easier to dissolve away. Our challenge is to figure out how to create these environments. We really need, and I know it sounds kind of corny, we need to be very loving, very accepting, and very patient with people who have these problems. And if we are, they will have a much higher probability of getting better. We need to absorb in our minds and guts the utter futility of what we are doing now. We need to wake to the reality that our present system actively generates misery for users and non-users alike and places intolerable burdens on society. More of the same will only cause more of the same. A 2007 study by physicians and researchers at the BC Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS stated that the federal government continues to invest heavily in policies and practices that have been repeatedly shown in the scientific literature to be ineffective or harmful. According to a front-page report in the Globe and Mail, the study found that law enforcement consumed by far the largest chunk, 73%, of the National Drug Strategy's annual $245 million budget, with no demonstrated impact on curbing the use of illegal drugs. At the same time, 14% is spent on treatment, 7% on research, and 3% each for addiction prevention and harm reduction. I'm paid to treat disease, said one of the authors, Dr. Thomas Kerr, and I don't like what I'm seeing. Canada simply does not have an evidence-based drug strategy. There's way too much ideology and politics, and not enough science and principle. On the same morning that this new study was reported, my last patient was Serena, the young native woman from Kelowna whose life story is described in Chapter 4. She came late, panting into my office with a high fever and a strangulating cough. Her pneumonia had begun several days before that, when she woke up after one of Vancouver's heavy windstorms to find that the windows of her hotel room had been shattered during the night and the water in her sink was frozen solid. In a commentary published in the Globe's web edition, I summarized Serena's history and explained that she deals drugs only to support her own cocaine habit. Proper nutrition, shelter, the controlled provision of their substances of dependence, counseling, and compassionate care are what most addicts need if we are to help wean them from their debilitating habits, I wrote. The piece ignited a lively set of exchanges at the newspaper's website, indicating how deeply felt are the views of many people on the issue of drug addiction. I was encouraged by the discourse. Many participants seemed interested in basing social policies not on subjective emotional responses toward addicts, but on facts and compassionate principle. This is an excellent discussion that shows the complexity of the issue and the lack of perfect solutions, wrote one of the contributors. Few harm reductionists who know their stuff recommend a market-led free-for-all in drugs like heroin and cocaine and the amphetamine stimulants. But there is now an undisputable body of evidence that demonstrates that developing mechanisms to make safer forms of these drugs available to those with an intractable need brings enormous benefits to both the drug user and the society around them. Thus, both Holland and Switzerland and parts of Germany have changed policies and seen an enormous drop in the levels of drug-related crime. The average age of hard drug users is rising there, indicating that fewer young people are taking up such an activity. The real obscenity here is the shocking lack of funding for treatment and care and harm reduction initiatives that have been shown to work. The UK National Treatment Outcomes Survey, known as ENTROS, showed that for every £1 invested in treatment and care, £3 came back in healthcare and enforcement savings. If such a return was available in the financial markets, we'd all rush to take advantage. Would the decriminalization of drug use and the controlled distribution of drugs bring up a new set of problems? No doubt they would. Innumerable practical issues would need to be resolved, some extremely complicated, and there would be risks. Around drug addiction, there are no easy, risk-free solutions to be found. But for every fresh difficulty, there would be new benefits that would weigh far more in the balance. No foreseeable risk can to any degree resemble the tremendous harm currently being done. Chapter 28. A Necessary Small Step. Harm Reduction. Whatever the arguments in its favor, a rational, evidence-based, and integrated drug policy is unlikely to emerge in the near future. With no enlightened social consensus on the horizon, we are left with the question, still an important one, of how to limit the harm suffered by the addict. In this chapter, we'll explore the hotly debated and much misunderstood issue of harm reduction. Nearly 8 years ago, on my very first day as the Portland doctor, I was guided up to the top floor of the old hotel to meet a resident described as a difficult patient. As the nurse and I entered his room, Claude, a man from Quebec in his late 30s, was kneeling on the floor, peering down into a mirror that lay horizontally on his bed. Grimacing, head tilted to one side, his prematurely graying hair falling over his temples, Claude pulled on the skin and muscles of his neck with his left hand while he attempted to inject a vein with some cloudy fluid from the syringe he held in his right. I watched as he poked himself in the neck once or twice without finding a blood vessel. "Tabernacle," came the well-known Quebecois curse. "You're asking for a brain abscess if you keep that up," I said, becoming alarmed at this inept display. "Let's see if we can't find you a safer spot to inject." Wrapping a rubber tourniquet from the nurse's bag around Claude's left arm, I asked him to pump his hand a few times. When a vein bulged below his elbow crease, I instructed him to insert the needle. He did, and as he pulled on the plunger, blood surged back into the syringe. The nurse removed the rubber hose, and our patient injected himself with whatever concoction he had prepared. We made him a gift of the tourniquet. I had never imagined that my medical career would lead me to assist an addict's self-administration of an illicit psychoactive substance in a musty downtown East Side hotel. Even on the way up to his room, I was not expecting to do anything of the sort. My intention was to discuss his HIV treatment. Under the circumstances, however, it was the best I could do for him. Without that help, Claude would have persisted in his attempts to inject a neck vein, a procedure with a high risk ratio. I had no realistic hope of dissuading him from self-injection, let alone of curing his long-established drug habit. The immediate goal was to reduce potential harm, and beyond that, to establish a relationship with Claude in which he could feel open and trusting enough to receive medical support and advice. Such was my rapid immersion in harm reduction. Claude died over 2 years ago from complications of HIV. He had been one of the Portland's longtime residents, one whose highly original personality and sense of humor make him stand out among the ranks of the departed. He was not a difficult patient after all, only someone who liked to do things his way and did not readily trust authority. He was an accomplished artist. A small, finely crafted aluminum wire bicycle, a memento of his dexterity and creative skill, stands on the windowsill of my kitchen to this day, a gift from Claude. During his last 4 years, despite his medical treatment being compromised by his addiction, we did much to extend his life, to prevent symptoms, and in the end, to ease his physical and emotional distress. What is harm reduction? Harm reduction is often perceived as being inimical to the ultimate purpose of curing addiction, that is, of helping addicts transcend their habits and to heal. People regard it as coddling addicts, as enabling them to continue their destructive ways. It's also considered to be the opposite of abstinence, which many regard as the only legitimate goal of addiction treatment. Such a distinction is artificial. The issue in medical practice is always how best to help a patient. If a cure is possible and probable without doing greater harm, then cure is the objective. When it isn't, and in most chronic medical conditions, cure is not the expected outcome, the physician's role is to help the patient with the symptoms and to reduce the harm done by the disease process. In rheumatoid arthritis, for example, one aims to prevent joint inflammation and bone destruction and in all events, to reduce pain. In incurable cancers, we aim to prolong life, if that can be achieved without a loss of life quality, and also to control symptoms. In other words, harm reduction means making the lives of afflicted human beings more bearable, more worth living. That is also the goal of harm reduction in the context of addiction. Although hardcore drug addiction is much more than a disease, the harm reduction model is essential to its treatment. Given our lack of a systematic, evidence-based approach to addiction, in many cases it's futile to dream of a cure. So long as society ostracizes the addict and the legal system does everything it can to heighten the drug problem, the welfare and medical systems can aim only to mitigate some of its effects. Sad to say, in our context, harm reduction means reducing not only the harm caused by the disease of addiction, but also the harm caused by the social assault on drug addicts. We will look shortly at some harm reduction measures. First, however, we'll dispense with two prevalent arguments against harm reduction, that it squanders resources on undeserving people who are the authors of their own misfortune, and that it justifies and enables addiction. If our guiding principle is that a person who makes his own bed ought to lie in it, we should immediately dismantle much of our healthcare system. Many diseases and conditions arise from self-chosen habits or circumstances and could be prevented by more astute decisions. According to a recent study by British Columbia's health officer, the provincial government spends $1.8 billion on diseases caused by unhealthy lifestyles. If BC accounts for 10% of Canada's population, the national figure would be about $20 billion annually. By extension, the comparable U.S. sum would be over $200 billion per year. The average per capita healthcare cost for those with no risk factors is $1,003, compared with $2,086 per capita for those with three risk factors, including smoking, being overweight, obese, and physically inactive. All of these factors, we might say, represent choices. And even after a heart attack, for instance, some patients will continue to bring these risks upon themselves. The same is true of people with chronic bronchitis who persist in smoking, skiers who brave moguls and steep slopes despite having sustained fractures, and people who remain in a stressful marriage despite requiring treatment for depression or anxiety. No cardiologist, respiratory specialist, orthopedic surgeon, or psychiatrist would refuse treatment on the ground that the problem was self-inflicted. When it comes to drug addicts, some people believe we ought to apply different criteria. One afternoon in August 2006, I called a CBC radio program to discuss Insight, Vancouver's controversial supervised injection facility for drug users. Just before the moderator turned to me, he interviewed an RCMP officer. "Dozens of addicts who have overdosed at Insight have been successfully resuscitated," the host pointed out. "Lives have been saved that might otherwise have been lost." "That's not necessarily a good thing," the Mountie spokesman explained. "It's well known that negative consequences are the only major deterrent to drug use. If you are saving people's lives, you are sending the message that it's safe to use drugs." This officer, on behalf of Canada's National Law Enforcement Agency, seemed willing to let people die in the hope of teaching a lesson. He seemed unaware, or not to care, that in the 1990s, Vancouver's injection users had received an average of 147 such lessons every year in the form of overdose deaths, without any discernible deterrent effect. It would be encouraging to believe that such a dark perspective is confined to the minds of some police officers. Not quite so. At about this same time, the Globe and Mail published an article on Insight that approvingly quoted Anthony Daniels, a retired British psychiatrist. "I suppose the argument for the safe injection site is that it would reduce the number of deaths," he told Globe columnist Gary Mason. "But I don't see why we should reduce the number of deaths. It is not our responsibility to do so. It is the responsibility of the addicts themselves. If they want to inject themselves with heroin, it's a very bad choice. If people die from it, I don't feel any particular guilt because I don't feel any responsibility for it." It would have been instructive to know whether or not the psychiatrist and his faithful scribe at the Globe were willing to extend this principle to other groups, such as, say, smokers with lung cancer or emphysema, type A business executives who work themselves into a heart attack, battered women who remain loyal to an abusive partner, or people injured in automobile accidents in full knowledge of the risks of driving. According to this same logic, no smoker should be defibrillated and brought back to life after a heart attack, and no one who drinks alcohol should receive a blood transfusion in the wake of intestinal bleeding. Anyone worried about the possibility of a myocardial infarction or a stroke ought to wear a large badge identifying him as a non-smoker, non-drinker, regular exerciser, and non-consumer of trans fatty acids. Absent such a marker, no bystander should even dial 911 on their behalf. Although we are all responsible for our lives, no human or medical principle dictates that we refuse to help others whose own decisions have brought trouble upon their heads, unless we believe that in trying to help them we are perpetrating greater harm. That would perhaps be the case if harm reduction could be shown to enable substance abuse, but as we have seen, hardcore drug users do not wait to be enabled, and there are few harsh consequences they haven't yet experienced. There is no evidence from anywhere in the world that harm reduction measures encourage drug use. Denying addicts humane assistance multiplies their miseries without bringing them one inch closer to recovery. There is also no contradiction between harm reduction and abstinence. The two objectives are incompatible only if we imagine that we can set the agenda for someone else's life regardless of what he or she may choose. We cannot. Short of extreme coercion, there is absolutely nothing anyone can do to induce another to give up addiction, except, as discussed in the previous chapter, to provide the island of relief where contemplation and self-respect can, perhaps, take root. Those ready to choose abstinence should receive every possible support, much more support than we currently provide. But what of those who don't choose that path? The impossibility of changing other people is not restricted to addictions. Try as we may to motivate another person to be different or to do this or not to do that, our attempts founder on a basic human trait, the drive for autonomy. And one may choose what is contrary to one's own interests, and sometimes one positively ought, wrote Fyodor Dostoevsky in Notes from the Underground. What man wants is simply independent choice, whatever that independence may cost and wherever it may lead. The issue is not whether the addict would be better off without his habit, of course he would, but whether we are going to abandon him if he is unable to give it up. Are we willing to care for human beings who suffer because of their own persistent behaviors, mindful that these behaviors stem from early life misfortunes they had no hand in creating? The harm reduction approach accepts that some people, many people, are too deeply enmeshed in substance dependence for any realistic cure under present circumstances. There is, for now, too much pain in their lives and too few internal and external resources available to them. In practicing harm reduction, we do not give up on abstinence. On the contrary, we may hope to encourage that possibility by helping people feel better, bringing them into therapeutic relationships with caregivers, offering them a sense of trust, removing judgment from our interactions with them, and giving them a sense of acceptance. At the same time, we do not hold out abstinence as the Holy Grail, and we do not make our evaluation of addicts as worthwhile human beings dependent on their making choices that please us. Harm reduction is as much an attitude and way of being as it is a set of policies and methods. Bruce Perry's words are worth recalling here. We need to be very loving, very accepting, and very patient with people who have these problems, and if we are, they will have a much higher probability of getting better. Specific harm reduction practices depend on resources and need. One such practice is the prescription of methadone. These days, I write regular methadone scripts for over 100 patients. The drug is a synthetic narcotic that occupies opiate receptors on brain cells, blocking the access of heroin molecules to the same binding site. When ingested orally, it does not cause a high in chronic narcotic users, but for many addicts, it prevents heroin craving and also withdrawal symptoms such as nervousness, pain, diarrhea, and nausea. In non-addicts, methadone is a more potent analgesic than morphine, but addicts on methadone often become tolerant to its pain-killing effects. It's long-acting, so a once-daily dose will see most people through 24 hours. It is estimated that there are 60,000 to 90,000 illicit opioid abusers in Canada, but only about a quarter are receiving treatment. U.S. treatment figures would be much lower, given the near impossibility of obtaining this medication in many jurisdictions. We offer methadone maintenance to addicts, not to cure them of their narcotic dependence, but to transfer that dependence to a narcotic that is legal, safe if ingested properly, and which prevents them from having to prostitute themselves, steal, and beg to avoid withdrawal. An addict chooses methadone when he tires of the endless daily scrounging for illicit narcotics and of the consequences of always having to dodge the law. None of my methadone patients would accept abstinence as an alternative to heroin use, and even with methadone, the heroin craving remains irresistible for some. There is no drug analogous to methadone to help with cocaine addiction. There have been some potentially encouraging trials with methylphenidate, Ritalin, and other stimulant preparations, and I have had some limited success in prescribing such medications to decrease people's reliance on cocaine and crystal meth. For a few patients, the difference has been dramatic. I would like to see long-acting stimulants investigated more vigorously, despite their own addiction potential. It would be preferable, if possible, to have people dependent on an oral stimulant in a controlled dose rather than on smoked or injected cocaine or crystal meth. Needle exchange is another harm reduction tactic. Users bring in dirty syringes and needles and are given new ones. The spread of HIV and hepatitis C from one person to another occurs by way of body fluids, specifically blood or sexual secretions. Clean, unshared needles limit disease transmission, as does the use of condoms during intercourse. Clean needles also help prevent skin infections, abscesses, and the spread of bacteria via the bloodstream. Even this simple measure is opposed by those who believe, once more, that somehow it condones or encourages addiction. As of this writing, the U.S. government has long refused to support needle exchange programs on the grounds that it encourages addiction. As if the addict were just waiting for federally funded clean needles to embark upon and maintain his habit. Why this hidebound resistance to a simple harm reduction and disease prevention method? People often talk about America's Puritan origins as the reason for opposition to needle exchange, says Daniel Wolf, director of the New York-based International Harm Reduction Development Program at the Open Society Institute. But it's actually evangelism that underlies most of the politics against needle exchange. To give someone a needle or methadone is seen as giving up on the idea that they can be saved and a moral failure for both drug user and care provider. The moral reality of leaving drug users to die of HIV because you refuse to adjust this vision of redemption to reality, or the moral implications of turning our anti-harm reduction ideology into a global crusade, go unexamined. The ban on federal funds for needle exchange in the U.S., the only such restriction in the world, finds further reinforcement in the American hostility to central government assistance to people in need. Unless, one is tempted to add, the people in need owing to their own poor choices are shareholders of Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae.
Not all addicts will accept methadone as a substitute. Just as for some others whose drug of choice is morphine, neither methadone nor heroin will do. In such cases, we can leave the addict to fend for herself in the underworld jungle, or we can offer heroin or morphine, unadulterated by who knows what impurities, to be self-injected in a clean environment with uncontaminated needles. We are neither condoning nor encouraging addiction. The addiction exists, and will continue to savage that person's life no matter what we believe. Our only choice is between compassion and indifference. By administering heroin in a controlled fashion, we are attempting to minimize harm for the addict, with the social benefit of reducing crime, squalor, and medical expenses. The North American Opiate Medication Initiative, NAOMI, is a trial of controlled heroin administration in several cities, including Vancouver, where the project operates out of a corner storefront one block away from the Portland Hotel. A spokesperson in the office of John Walters, director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, called it an inhumane medical experiment. There is another way to see it. The NAOMI trial is evaluating a method to lessen society's inhumanity toward drug addicts. The study's chief value may be to convince skeptics, since from the medical and social perspectives, evidence is hardly required. We have decades of experience in Europe to draw on. In the United Kingdom, opiate maintenance programs were administered from the 1920s to the 1970s, but fell into disfavor under heavy U.S. opposition. Since then, despite the war on drugs, or perhaps, in part, owing to it, the number of British opiate addicts has soared exponentially. One exception to the abandonment of heroin maintenance in the UK has been the Drug Dependency Service in the Merseyside area. All addicts registering with the program are offered treatment, including inpatient detoxification. Only about 10% elect approaches leading to abstinence. The rest are prescribed narcotics in various forms, from the injectable to the inhaled. Among the results has been the second lowest rate of HIV-positive drug users in all English regions, less than a quarter of the national average, as well as a reduction in criminal activity. In 1991, the Merseyside police were the only force in the UK to register a decrease in crime rates. In the 1990s, Switzerland, facing Europe's highest HIV infection rate from injection drug use, initiated a trial of either heroin maintenance or of methadone treatment supplemented with heroin. The findings were: fitness for work improved considerably, permanent employment more than doubled. Patients' housing situations rapidly improved and stabilized. In particular, there was no homelessness. No fatal overdose due to prescribed substances. No notable disturbances in local neighborhoods. Significant economic benefits in terms of savings per patient day owing to marked reductions in legal and health costs. And a marked decrease in crime of all kinds, from shoplifting to drug dealing. Overall offenses down by 68%. The Swiss achieved these effects, write two North American academic researchers, through a careful evaluation of prescribed heroin for over 1,000 of the country's most refractory long-term heroin addicts, targeting the most difficult of individuals who have had long-term difficulties with substance misuse and repeated failures with traditional abstinence-based approaches to treatment. The Swiss studies showed unequivocally that prescribing heroin produces substantial declines both in illicit drug use and in criminal activity for this most problematic group. In addition, they provided clear evidence of improved social reintegration, i.e. better housing, more gainful employment, fewer drug associates, and more contact with previously estranged families and friends. The current NAOMI project's largest flaw is that the study's limitations curtail the time an addict can take part in it. Jenny, a 29-year-old Portland hotel resident and sex trade worker, was in my office a few weeks ago asking to be reinstated on methadone. For a year, she had been receiving heroin at the NAOMI site. Her health had improved, and contrary to previous times, during this period, I had not had to treat her for infectious diseases. Now she presented with a red, swollen right leg and an abscess in her groin where she had self-injected street heroin. The problem? Her scheduled participation at NAOMI had come to an end. Owing largely to U.S. opposition, heroin maintenance is unavailable in Canada
outside this research project. I would bet any amount of money the U.S. has exerted extreme pressure on Canada to abort this trial, Dr. Alex Wodak, a prominent Australian addiction physician, said when Naomi was just beginning. Dr. Wodak, director of the Alcohol and Drug Service at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, was in a position to know. U.S. opposition had helped to abort an Australian heroin trial in 1997. We in Vancouver have also not been spared White House advice regarding InSite, the supervised injection site, SIS, administered by the Portland Hotel Society in conjunction with local health authorities. John Walters, the White House drug czar, has called this project state-assisted slow suicide. The White House drug czar was actually reported to have said slow-assisted state suicide, but we can assume this is what he meant. When you walk into the injection room at InSite on Hastings Street, you see about a dozen cubicles, each with a sink, clean needles, a large mirror, lighting, towel, and alcohol swabs for cleansing the skin. At first blink, it's as if you'd entered the dressing room in an off-Broadway theater. A nurse is present at all times, observing the addicts who occupy the cubicles and wrap clean tourniquets around their arms before they probe their own veins with syringe and needle. Next door is a chill lounge, where coffee is served and where staff and counselors engage addicts in conversation. There is also a treatment room at the facility and all the equipment and medications needed for resuscitating overdosed users. That equipment has not lain idle. In an 18-month period, there were nearly 500 overdoses at InSite, but no deaths. The accepted assumption is that there is about a 5% mortality rate without intervention, in which case 25 lives have been saved, to the likely disapproval of the Mounties and the British psychiatrist Dr. Daniels, who, we may guess, would also prefer to see addicts continue to inject themselves with puddle water, as was sometimes the case prior to InSite. More than 5,000 users are registered with InSite, of whom over 600 visit on any given day. None of the fears generated before this facility began to operate in 2003 have been realized. It has not encouraged drug use or drug-related crime. It has not brought more dealers into the areas, and it has not made the streets less safe. More than 20 studies published in the Journal of the Canadian Medical Association, the British Medical Journal, Lancet, the New England Journal of Medicine, and other peer-reviewed journals have documented its benefits. The program is attracting the highest risk users, those most likely to be vulnerable to HIV infection and overdose, public drug use, and unsafe syringe disposal, has reduced the number of people injecting in public and the amount of injection-related litter in the downtown East Side, has reduced hassles for local businesses, has reduced overall rates of needle sharing in the community, is not increasing rates of relapse among former drug users, nor is it a negative influence on those seeking to stop drug use, has led to increased enrollment in detoxification programs and addiction treatment, and has not drawn drug users from other areas into the neighborhood. As summed up in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, Vancouver's safer injecting facility has been associated with an array of community and public health benefits without evidence of adverse impacts. The city's current mayor and his three most recent predecessors, including the present premier of British Columbia, no liberal when it comes to social policy, support the continuation of InSite. Despite initial skepticism, so do local merchants and the Vancouver Police Department. Inspector Scott Thompson, head of Youth Services and Drug Policy Coordinator for the VPD, rebuked the RCMP publicly for its opposition to InSite, a resistance that persisted despite internal RCMP studies vindicating the project. We're the ones on the ground, and we support the public health objectives of reducing fatal overdoses and lessening the risk of HIV and AIDS among drug users, he said. The evidence in favor of InSite is so overwhelming, the Vancouver Sun noted in an editorial, that police chiefs in Great Britain have backed a proposal to open supervised injection sites in that country. In September 2007, the services offered at InSite were enhanced by a detox center in the same building called OnSite. Here, addicts, both male and female, are supported through the process of withdrawal without being permitted to use drugs. And short-term housing is available for those wishing to leave domiciles where substance abuse is rampant. The detox floor has 12 rooms, each with its own bathroom, which provides unprecedented privacy unknown at other local facilities. It's very painful to withdraw, and you really don't want to be around people and doing a lot of throwing up, a recovering heroin addict explained to a journalist. I'm one of the two physicians currently providing medical care at this venue. In September 2006, the 3-year federal authorization for the supervised injection site was to run out. During its successful campaign in the previous election, the Conservative Party had indicated its distaste for everything but abstinence-based drug programs. Now the government of Prime Minister Stephen Harper was flooded with requests from politicians, police and health authorities, citizens groups, users advocates, and many individuals to permit InSite to continue. As a physician whose patients are served by the supervised injection site, I also penned a letter to Mr. Harper. The SIS is a facility that attempts, in a modest but essential way, to reduce the harm attendant on the disease of dependence, I wrote. This is a difficult population to work with. Because of their uniformly tragic early childhood histories, they do not well know how to take care of themselves, and they do not readily seek help from health providers. The SIS is a link, for some their only link, between their street lives and the healthcare system, and for many, it is one of the first institutions they have encountered where they feel treated in a supportive, humane way. For the physically and emotionally wounded people they are, that is no small matter. The SIS is far from a full answer to the complex problem of drug addiction, but it is an innovative and necessary small step. A project Canada can be proud of, one that in time will be emulated in many jurisdictions around the world. In the end, the government decided to shut down InSite, stopped only by a British Columbia Supreme Court judgment that the facility served a genuine medical need that the government was constitution-bound to maintain. The federal health minister, who had previously said there was insufficient evidence that the program reduces drug use and fights addiction, announced his intention to appeal the ruling. In the U.S., too, despite federal opposition, harm reduction measures are gaining support. On the harm reduction front, the U.S. has been so much slower than the rest of the world, says Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance. But on the other hand, we have hundreds of cities and over half the states that support clean needle programs. There are also encouraging shifts on the political front. In 1988, for example, members of the Congressional Black Caucus called needle exchange a form of genocide. 10 years later, the caucus was calling for the resignation of drug czar Barry McCaffrey for his failure to support funding for clean needle programs. Then Senator Barack Obama also called for a more open-minded approach. I believe in shifting the paradigm, shifting the model, so that we can focus more on a public health approach, he told Rolling Stone magazine in a July 2008 interview. That promised paradigm shift is long overdue, and Canada's health minister, along with many of his fellow political leaders across North America, needs an urgent education in harm reduction. A harm reduction program does not fight addiction, whatever that means. It only reduces misery and prevents death and disease. The controversy has demonstrated that harm reduction may not be a medical or social question at all. The issue is not what's best for either the addicted person or for society. At heart, it's a matter of ideology. Inflamed phrases such as inhumane medical experiment and state-assisted slow suicide are spoken, it seems to me, in the language of people with a higher regard for their own convictions than for the facts. Part 7. The Ecology of Healing. The problem is not that the truth is harsh, but that liberation from ignorance is as painful as being born. Run after truth until you're breathless. accept the pain involved in recreating yourself afresh. These ideas will take a life to comprehend, a hard one, interspersed with drunken moments. Naguib Mahfouz, Palace of Desire. Chapter 29. The Power of Compassionate Curiosity. These concluding chapters are intended to enhance the reader's understanding of the addicted mind and to support healing. They are not a guide for treating active substance dependence. Under the influence of brain-altering chemicals, it's not possible for users to sustain the self-compassionate stance and conscious mental effort required to heal their addicted minds. The information and advice given here may complement, but cannot replace, treatment programs or self-help groups for addictions of any kind. I had hoped to end this book on a triumphant note. I wanted, in this section on the self-healing of addiction, to describe how I overcame my addictive tendencies. Unfortunately, such a tale, while possibly uplifting and feel-good, would have to be filed in the fiction aisles. For much of the writing of Hungry Ghosts, I continued to relapse, binging, lying, shamed and hollow. Despite my earnest resolutions, I never returned to the 12-step group, nor did I follow any other program consistently. I was like Dean, Canada's self-described most famous junkie, who vowed at the beginning of the documentary Fix that by film's end he would clean up his act. He didn't, and I didn't. Or at least in my case, not until recently. Too recently to stand flak jacketed on an aircraft carrier and shout, "Mission accomplished." Mission accepted would be more accurate. We teach what we most need to learn, and sometimes give what we most need to receive. It was impossible to study addiction without observing myself closely, and I can say truthfully that I have learned much through this exercise. No matter how hard I try, I have found out that I may never fully defeat my addiction-prone tendencies. And I've also learned that this is all right. Triumph and defeat, these are still metaphors of war. If, as the research shows, addictions arise near our emotional core, to defeat them we would have to wage a war against ourselves, and a war against parts of the self, even against non-adaptive, dysfunctional parts, can lead only to inner discord and more distress. One day this winter, Nurse Kim and I met with a 31-year-old woman, a heroin and cocaine addict I will call Clarissa. Clarissa has had 3 children taken away from her by child protection authorities and is now expecting again. She admits she is high on cocaine, not that she could conceal that fact, given her restless, agitated body movements, staccato speech, and emotional reactivity. "But I'm like this even without the rock," she pleads, and she is, nearly, due to severe attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. "I hate myself," she says. "I've known I've been pregnant for weeks, and I haven't stopped hooting. I've been fucking up, feeling sorry for myself, and not thinking about the baby." Kim and I listen without interruption, as Clarissa lurches from self-accusation to complaints about the staff to demands for food supplements and a new 2-room apartment. In the midst of the tirade, she stops speaking, sucks in a deep breath, buries her face in her palms, and sobs, "I'm scared. I'm so very scared." Clarissa sits on the sofa by the window, her tear-brimmed eyes skipping from nurse to doctor to the street scene outside. Her half-bare breasts, enlarged by the hormones of gestation, quiver in the push-up bra she wears to help attract potential customers. A few questions, and the distraught young woman's life story pours out. The all-too-familiar, well-nigh formulaic, Downtown East Side life story. As ever, the tale is so toxic the sheer hearing of it leaves one benumbed. Clarissa was sexually abused by her father from age 1 to 4, and after that, by a series of men until she was a teenager. By the time she was 5 years old, her mother was dead of an overdose. "My mom was a junkie even when she carried me in her belly," she says, "and now I'm doing it to my own kid." Kim and I hear her out, give what counsel we can, and take the necessary steps. First is a dating ultrasound. Clarissa's wishes are to terminate if the pregnancy is not past 12 weeks, or to give up her drug use and move into a shelter for pregnant women if she is beyond the early abortion stage. We support her intention to discontinue the cocaine, but warn that putting the fetus through a narcotic withdrawal is not desirable. It would be better to replace the heroin with low-dose methadone for the duration of the pregnancy. I write a couple of notes for Clarissa's financial aid worker before Kim drives her to Shiwei, the downtown East Side prenatal care clinic. "Just one bit of advice," I say, "if you think you can listen." Clarissa, on her way out of the office, turns to glance back at me.
"I can listen," she says.
"What you said about hating yourself and feeling sorry for yourself. What if you were to replace your harsh judgments with some genuine curiosity about why you do what you do? What if you use drugs because you're afraid that you can't bear the pain without them? You have every reason to feel hurt after all you've been through. It's not a matter of fucking up. You just haven't found any other way to cope. If your child had had the same experiences and ended up on drugs, would you accuse her so harshly?"
"No," Clarissa says. "I'd love her. I'd give her tough love."
"Forget the tough," I tell her. "All she'd need is your love. And so do you." Clarissa, weeping again, asks if she can come back to talk to me. "Sure," I say, "but come back when you're not stoned. You can't absorb anything when you're high." "That's what my counselors always told me when I was a teenager," Clarissa protests, "not to come back when I'm stoned, but it's not true." I look at her for a few silent moments and relent. "Okay, come back whichever way you need to come back." Clarissa is all smiles.
"That's what I wanted to hear," she says.
When I'm reasonably balanced in my personal and spiritual life, I don't have difficulty finding compassion for my addicted patients. I'm curious about their life histories and self-perceptions, and for the most part, I'm able to avoid imposing judgments on them. As with Clarissa, my aim is to open their eyes to the possibility of a non-judgmental, compassionate curiosity toward themselves. Things are very different when it comes to my own self in the midst of an addicted phase. Suffused with corrosive shame, I attempt to hide the self-loathing from my own sight with feigned joviality or self-justifying combativeness, neither of which do the job near adequately. As with my drug-dependent, fellow hungry ghosts, this slush of pitiless, negative self-judgment only intensifies the desire for escape and oblivion. The spiral of addiction, shame, addiction keeps swirling on. As Dr. Bruce Perry said about drug addicts, we need to be very loving, very accepting, and very patient with people who have these problems. We also need to extend that same loving, accepting, and patient attitude toward ourselves. And, as Dr. Jaak Pansep has suggested, to deal successfully with addictions, we have to bring emotions back into healthy balance. We have to give ourselves a chance to think about it. When we're awash in a poisonous soup of self-recrimination and shame, we cannot think creatively. Among the necessary initial moves towards sobriety is the directing of compassionate curiosity at oneself. Many teachings, from spiritual writings to psychological works, tell us that we need to look at ourselves this way. In cultivating loving kindness, we learn first to be honest, loving, and compassionate towards ourselves, writes the American Buddhist nun Pema Chodron. Rather than nurturing self-denigration, we begin to cultivate a clear-seeing kindness. Chodron also suggests it's a good idea to lighten up. Being able to lighten up is the key to feeling at home with your body, mind, and emotions, to feeling worthy of living on this planet. In addition to a sense of humor, a basic support for a joyful mind is curiosity, paying attention. Happiness is not required, but being curious without a heavy judgmental attitude helps. If you are judgmental, you can even be curious about that. Posed in a tone of compassionate curiosity, why is transformed from rigid accusation to an open-minded, even scientific question. Instead of hurling an accusatory brick at your own head, for example, "I'm so stupid, when will I ever learn," etc.,
The question, why did I do this again, knowing full well the negative consequences, can become the subject of a fruitful inquiry, a gentle investigation. Taking off the starched uniform of the interrogator, who is determined to try, convict, and punish, we adopt toward ourselves the attitude of the empathic friend, who simply wants to know what's going on with us. The acronym COAL has been proposed for this attitude of compassionate curiosity. Curiosity, openness, acceptance, and love. I wonder what drove me to do this again. The purpose is not to justify or rationalize, but to understand. Justification is another form of judgment every bit as debilitating as condemnation. When we justify, we hope to win the judge's favor, or to hoodwink her. Justification connives to absolve the self of responsibility. Understanding helps us assume responsibility. When we don't have to defend ourselves against others or, what's more, against ourselves, we are open to seeing how things are. I become free to acknowledge the addiction the moment the fact of having behaved along addictive patterns no longer means that I'm a failure as a person, unworthy of respect, shallow and valueless. I can own it and see the many ways it sabotages my real goals in life. Being cut off from our own natural self-compassion is one of the greatest impairments we can suffer. Along with our ability to feel our own pain, go our best hopes for healing, dignity, and love. What seems non-adaptive and self-harming in the present was, at some point in our lives, an adaptation to help us endure what we then had to go through. If people are addicted to self-soothing behaviors, it's only because in their formative years, they did not receive the soothing they needed. Such understanding helps delete toxic self-judgment on the past and supports responsibility for the now. Hence the need for compassionate self-inquiry. If I examine my addictive behaviors without judgment and ask why, in the spirit of compassionate curiosity, what do I find? More to the point, whom do I find? What is the full truth of me? Is it that I'm a respected 30-year veteran of medical practice, spouse and parent, counselor, public speaker, activist, and author? What about the anxious, insecure man who has often felt empty and incomplete and has looked to the outside to allay some insatiable hunger? As fellow addict and author Stephen Reed said during our conversation in the cafeteria of the William Head Penitentiary, "Makes my teeth hurt, the work of pulling back from all those outside things and looking inside myself." In my case, the unconscious tension literally made my teeth hurt. So forcefully have I ground my teeth at night since childhood that by the end of my fifth decade, most of them were whittled stubs with the pulp exposed. Along with my positive qualities, intellectual confidence, strengths, passions, and commitments, there has always lurked near the very core of me a churning, inchoate anxiety. Had I been able to be honest with myself and had I been prepared to accept vulnerability, I would have declared at many stages of my life, as Clarissa did, "I'm scared. I'm so very scared." My anxiety clothes itself in concerns about body image or financial security, doubts regarding lovability or the ability to love, self-disparagement and existential pessimism about life's meaning and purpose, or, on the other hand, it manifests itself as grandiosity, the need to be admired, to be seen as special. At bottom, it is nameless and formless. I feel sure it was forged in my chest cavity, somewhere between my lungs and heart, long before I knew the names of things. Do I have reasons to be anxious? By its very nature, chronic anxiety has nothing to do with reasons. First, it springs into being, and much later, once we develop the ability to think, it recruits thoughts and explanations to serve it. In contrast to healthy anxiety, for which a better word is fear, felt in the face of danger, like the fear a gazelle might experience in the presence of a hungry lion or that a small child might feel when his parents are not in sight, chronic anxiety is not rooted in the experience of the moment. It precedes thought. We may believe we're anxious about this or that, body image, the state of the world,
relationship issues, the weather. But no matter what story we weave around it, the anxiety just is. Like addiction itself, anxiety will always find a target, but exists